You're listening to a program produced in 2016 by Aloud, a series of dynamic conversations, readings, and performances that take place at the historic Central Library in downtown Los Angeles. Aloud is presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles, which supports the Los Angeles Public Library. To learn more, please visit lfla.org/aloud. This is actually our second Aloud time travel program this fall, if we count Colson Whitehead's novel, The Underground Railroad. But as James Glick points out in his grand thought experiment, Time Travel, A History, the very idea of time travel was brought into popular parlance by a novelist, H.G. Wells. And for those of us who grew up in the 50s and 60s, the movie of Wells' novel, The Time Machine, was, in fact, life-altering. My childhood best friend made a perfect miniature version of Wells' time machine, as envisioned by Hollywood prop builders, that little sledge with knobs and levers and a plush red seat. We really loved it. James Glick's book, new book is an inquiry into why we think about time, why its directionality troubles us, and how a scientific impossibility, sorry to break the news, is fertile ground for the artistic imagination. You might know James Glick from his many award-winning books. He's a great science writer, The Information, A History, A Theory, A Flood, or his first book, Chaos, a national bestseller. He's also the author of the biographies Genius, The Life and Science of Richard Feynman, and Isaac Newton, as well as Faster, The Acceleration of Just About Everything, and What Just Happened, A Chronicle from the Information Frontier. He was an editor and reporter at the New York Times for a decade, and his books have been translated into 30 languages. And in conversation with James Glick tonight is novelist Charles Yu, someone who is truly passionate about time travel, in fact, even practices the art. And if you read, or if you read Charles' fantastic recent story in The New Yorker, Fable, you'll know how he uses storytelling to move us inside and upside down in the space-time continuum. Charles Yu is the author of How to Live Safely in a Science Fiction Universe, and the story collections Third Class Superhero and Sorry, Please, Thank You. He was just recently on the writing team for the new HBO series Westworld. And of course, as many of you know, LA does have its own time travel store. How many of you knew that? Okay, let's hear it for 826 LA. The store is conveniently located in Echo Park on Sunset Boulevard, and I went there recently to purchase some time travel supplies for tonight. And I would now like to bring out our two guests, James Glick and Charles Yu, if you would come out. Welcome. And before you begin, I would like to present each of you with a passport to the past. One has a stamp for the Ice Age, and the other one is for the Viking era. We do not have any for the future. So, James, would you like to choose? Which one would you like?
I'll take this one.
The Viking, okay.
The Viking.
Okay. All right, take it away. Thank you so much. Have a good one.
James Glick is one of my favorite writers, so I'm going to say it into his face. And this book is on a topic that you could characterize as an obsession of mine. So the danger here was for me to go way into the rabbit hole and just end up picking your brain for an hour. So to counteract that tendency, I've tried to keep these hopefully somewhat fun and accessible. I have 700 or 800 questions to go through. We will be using time travel to finish this, but let's start here. At this point, time travel is a very ingrained idea. My kids are 9 and 7, and they can watch a cartoon in which an animated dog gets into a glass chamber, hits a button, disappears, reappears, you know, a moment later, and somehow the scene is subtly different, and they understand intuitively that the dog is now in a different present that was created by changing the past. I mean, they literally don't need an explanation of that, whereas if I watched that with my parents, they would have no idea what was going on, most likely. Despite the pervasiveness of time travel now as an idea, you write that it's actually a fairly recent discovery, invention.
Right. Invention. don't you think?
I don't know. I'm asking you.
Charles Yu is one of my favorite writers. But he knows this, because How to Live Safely in a Science Fictional Universe is one of the inspiring, it's probably the newest time travel novel that I write about in time travel. And it's an example of what you're talking about. And I mean, it's an example of how sophisticated we have gotten about these tropes and jokes. And we're smart about time. And so, yes, this was, you've put your finger on the thing that most surprised me when I started looking into time travel. And really the thing that made me think this made sense as a book, the fact that time travel is a new idea, and it's not just that our parents aren't quite as up to speed as children are on the intricacies mm-hmm. of the paradoxes, it's that 150 years ago, let's say, there was no such thing. I mean, there was just, the words literally had not been put together, time and travel. And I know this because I used Google's n-gram searching facility. The first person to create time travel as a thing was H.G. Wells, which was 1895, and in The Time Machine. And even he didn't talk about time travel as a thing because nobody knew about it yet. But his hero is called the Time Traveler. He doesn't even have a name. And he has to start the book in a really old-fashioned way, you know, with everybody gathered around the fireplace. I'm not sure there's literally a fireplace, but, you know, in his parlor. And he gives them a little lecture. He does some mansplaining, as we would call it now. And he says, I have to explain to you that everything you think you know about time is wrong. And he tells them that time is a fourth dimension. And, you know, Charlie's kids already know that time is a fourth dimension. And we all kind of know that because Einstein told us. Mm. But Einstein didn't tell us until 10 years after that.
Mm. 1905. The theory of general relativity.
Special theory of relativity. And it took a while. You know, we can date it to 1905, but it took a while for the ideas to percolate out. But then I thought, well, gee, did Einstein read H.G. Wells, you know, in translation into German, which wouldn't that have been a great thing to discover? But I doubt very much that he did, and it doesn't really matter. The real point is, of course, that they're living in the same universe where suddenly there are steam engines dashing across the landscape, forcing people to, for the first time, create time zones. Right? And there's the electric telegraph, which for the first time enables people to synchronize their clocks across great distances. And all of these ideas are floating around. And there are a lot of other ways in which it became more natural to think of time as a kind of version of space.
Mm.
So H.G. Wells and Einstein, they're just, you know, drinking the same Kool-Aid.
Right, right. Going, you know, a little deeper into that Einstein's theory 10 years later, but, you know, you kind of describe the context of time zones, of locomotive travel, of things. And so one of the sort of deeper ideas, I think, that you explore is the idea that an idea itself may not be able to ripen until people's, I guess, minds are ready for it in a way. And this invention couldn't have happened at a different time, I guess, or couldn't really have happened much earlier than it did. And the fact that it did at the time it did is meaningful to some extent. And I was just curious if you could talk about that and how at the sort of turn of the century, which is another kind of term that you right. discuss, if you could just sort of talk about that a little bit.
Yeah. Well, this is really, I guess, the story that I started with, it's not just a story of time travel as a toy to play with, but it is partly that, because it became that. But it's also something is happening in the whole culture that makes it possible for, it's not that, at least this is the way I like to think about it, this may be a kind of personal prejudice, but I don't start with the assumption that, aha, H.G. Wells, what a brilliant creative mind to come up with this idea of time travel. Finally, it was about time. Mm. I think it had to be in the air in some way, mm-hmm. ready for a great creative mind like Wells's to work with it. And as you say, the audience has to be ready to hear it and understand it, even though it's unfamiliar, the idea of traveling through time, getting on a machine, arriving in the future, it's completely unfamiliar to them, but it has to make a kind of sense. I mean, the book, it was Wells's first book. It was a bestseller. It was a big success. It was published in the U.S. very soon after. It made him famous. Mm. But at the same time, there's Marcel Proust, you know, who's practically a contemporary of Wells, and he's thinking about time in a way that you might think is completely different. His book is In Search of Lost Time. Mm. That's not an accident. His book is really about time, and it's about memory, and it uses tricks of perspective involving memory to tell his story in a very new way. Mm. And at least for me, it's not a stretch to say that that's a kind of time travel infiltrating, you know, great art. And and soon after that, there's James Joyce and Virginia Woolf, each in their own ways, twisting time into knots and doing new things with time. And showing that they were very much aware of the stuff around. They were aware of Einstein. Einstein may not have been aware of H.G. Wells, but James Joyce was certainly aware of Einstein and the way people were talking about space-time. Mm-hmm. All of this was, and so all this was new. And the argument I'm making is that there was a new kind of ferment around the idea of time that has become sort of invisible to us because we have our own kinds of ferment around that idea too. But so it's sort of healthy to go back and look at how new it all was.
In the book, you say that time travel is impossible, which makes me sad. So my question to you is, are you sure? For instance, tonight, this event has been publicized quite well, and I think it's being recorded. So if any future civilizations are watching this in an archive, this shall be the invitation right now. I'm extending it to you future people.
Right.
To come visit right now, which has been done before, I think, at MIT, I think, and maybe other places.
Stephen Hawking
did it. So we'll give
him
a moment. Stephen Hawking did it.
Yeah, Stephen Hawking printed up invitations to announcing a party that at a date that had already passed. Mm. And then he said, nobody showed up. So that proves that there are no time travelers in the future. And so, I mean, that's a kind of proof, I suppose. No, I'm not sure. What do you think, honestly?
I think they have 52 minutes to get here.
No,
and if
honestly,
they get here...
No, tell me the truth, honestly. Do you think that time travel is possible?
I mean...
You, Charles Yu, the author of a book in which the hero, Charles Yu, is a time machine technician...
I don't think that Wellesian time travel is possible. I think, and we could get into this later. This is a little bit down the rabbit hole, but we could talk about closed time-like curves and that sort of thing. But
five people just walked out.
Good, we didn't need them. But I think I'm sadly probably persuaded by your book. I think I was just a little bit...
I didn't mean to be persuasive about it. I meant to express a kind of warning to the reader.
Sure.
That but here's one of the reasons I asked you I'm pretty sure now that if you took, if this was a room full of physicists and you said, raise your hand if you believe that time travel is possible, a lot of hands would go up. Maybe all of them. If it was a room full of science fiction writers, the opposite. And I say this in my book, that it's the science fiction writers who are, and have always been, skeptical of the idea, because science fiction writers, oddly enough, tend to be fairly well grounded in, you know, common sense reality. H.G. Wells himself disappointed people for the next generation who were huge admirers of his. I mean, people, not just fans, but philosophers, people who were trying to write seriously about time, and kind of cited H.G. Wells as a guru for being a visionary who was prescient about the idea of time travel, about and really for seeing time in a way that Einstein saw time a few years later. I mean, the truth is, I'm not qualified, obviously, to say that time travel is impossible. I'm just sure that it's impossible. Because, and so to really spell it out, I'm expressing a view of how things are, which is, I'll call it the common sense man in the street view of how things are, which is the past happened, but it's not happening now. It happened then, and it's gone. The only thing that's happening now is the present, and it's very short. In fact, I said now a minute ago, but that's the past now. And the future, in my religious view, is wide open. Not necessarily entirely open, but it's pretty open. And nobody can say for sure what might and might not happen in the future. And this common sense view that I'm expressing is in conflict with a pretty basic idea of Einsteinian physics, the idea of a four-dimensional space-time continuum. Are we getting into the weeds now?
Where, here we go.
Okay, where past and the future, past and future are just new, other directions. They're just mirror images of each other, and they have the same kind of existence mathematically as the present does. And you can hear physicists say, you could Google this expression and you find a bunch of physicists saying it, the fundamental laws of physics do not distinguish between past and future. There is no directionality. There is no arrow of time in the fundamental laws of physics. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, that if you believe all that, then maybe time travel is possible. Mm-hmm. And yet, those same physicists admit that there are a lot of processes that do display a definite directionality about time. There is an arrow of time. The baby chick doesn't dissolve into the egg and the crumbled pieces of eggshell reform themselves around it.
You can't stir things apart.
Charlie is quoting Tom Stoppard, who, that's the single best short explanation of entropy I've ever heard. You can't stir things apart.
He nailed it.
He nailed it, yeah, and we're all done.
Right. Thank you. Right, so the idea that on a micro scale, you could watch, you know, milliseconds of a film, I guess, and watch a physical process. And from a short enough snippet, you wouldn't be able to tell if you're watching it forwards or backwards.
Right.
And physics.
On the micro scale, you're watching the atoms collide, and each collision between atoms is obeying the laws of physics, and it goes this way, but it also goes this way. They're the same both ways.
And then in the macro scale, there is this thing called entropy. And I thought it'd be, you know, I would love to hear your, you know, you wrote a whole book about information. You've written many things. You've written a whole book about chaos, and now you've written a book about time travel. You've probably done more thinking about entropy than, like, the average person, but maybe more than any other person, really. And
not the average person, yeah.
And there's the arrow of time in that sense, and then there's also possibly related, possibly unrelated, psychological arrow of time, in that we don't really remember the future, but we remember the past. And that asymmetry is related or not to entropy?
Oh, I absolutely believe it's related. And it's very real. And when physicists say, now we're not talking about the fundamental laws of physics, I think that just means we're not going to look at that kind of problem right now. Mm-hmm. But they have to look at it. I mean, that's a real problem. I mean, to continue the balls colliding, if you're watching a film of billiard balls, you know, you start with the rack of billiard balls in a perfect triangle, and then you break them and they carom all around. Well, the caroming all around, it's all obeying reversible laws of physics. Mm-hmm. But if you run the film backwards and you've got a lot of balls bouncing around for a while, and all of a sudden they assemble themselves into a perfect triangle, you know that can't happen. You know that now you're watching the film backwards. And so physicists have an obligation to explain that too. And what they say is, well, it's a matter of probabilities. It's not that it really can't happen, it's just that it's very unlikely for it to happen. Mm. Which is true. Mm. And yes, I think that everything to do with life and consciousness is also an entropic process. Information is very bound up with entropy in a way that we're really not going to get into tonight because
we like everybody here.
That's right, because we like you. But I will say this, that when Claude Shannon, the father of information theory, was he did make a connection between his new idea of information and entropy, but he wasn't calling it entropy yet, but supposedly John von Neumann told him, call it entropy, because then no one will know what you're talking about and no one will argue with you. A lot of things work only in one direction. And so, to bring this back to time travel, right. a thing that the physicists never have to deal with I'm jumping ahead now to the closed timeline curves. Mm-hmm. If physicists tell you, well, you could go backward in time, they're thinking about particles. We're not particles. We are a big, complicated ensemble of stuff. Not just the billiard balls, not just a few billiard balls, but if we are billiard balls, we're billions of billiard balls. I'm sorry I said that. And it's the complicated ensemble of stuff mm-hmm. that consciousness requires mm. to exist. And as you said, we remember the past. We don't remember the future. That is a one-way process. And our memory of the past and our formation of consciousness, I believe, are inextricably linked. I know you believe it too, because it's an issue you deal with in your novel. Or I shouldn't say I know that you believe it. Maybe you just fictionally believe it. But there is a real connection between, I think, between our ability to think about time, mm-hmm. to recognize the difference between the past and the present, and our ability to think about ourselves and recognize ourselves as ourselves, that is, to be conscious, to create a mental model of a person and recognize that person is a part of the same process that creates a mental model of the world and watches that model change and is able to compare the model moment by moment and create the illusion in your head of time passing, mm-hmm. which occasionally short circuits. And then you have phenomena like déjà vu. What is that? I know, somebody wants to know. And wait, this is something, I think this is relevant. I'm prepared.
I mean, I'm
quoting now from the novel How to Live Safely in a Science Fictional Universe by Charles Yu. Your brain has to trick itself to live in time. I think that's exactly right. I think that's exactly what's going on. Mm. So really, we've gotten pretty deep here in a short amount of time.
Yes, we're still in the first card.
Oh man! No.
I mean, you're getting to this really kind of sort of slippery idea for me, but the idea that time travel might be one of just the most powerful metaphors that we've ever come up with. In a way, Daniel Dennett has this term, intuition pump, that it might be this incredible way of thinking about our kind of embedded, invisible assumptions about all kinds of things. Causality, about free will, about continuity of self, as you're mm-hmm. talking about. And is there a kind of, I guess, circularity maybe in thinking about time with your brain, which may have evolved as a kind of organ for moving through time and not, for instance, getting eaten by a saber-toothed tiger or not, mm-hmm. you know, in other words, are we doing the impossible in trying to kind of bootstrap ourselves by using a sort of temporal organ to try to, you know, untie the knot of itself in a way? And that's not a question at all, so much as it's just a statement of utter confusion about time travel.
Yeah.
Does it make any sense?
Yeah. There's a hall of mirrors thing going on here, right? That the thing we're doing introspection to understand consciousness, and the thing we're using to do the looking is the thing that we're hoping to look at.
Right.
And yes, I do feel there's a connection with time travel. That's another version of the kind of loops that you get into. The first thing that people discovered happening, and H.G. Wells didn't discover this, because H.G. Wells' time traveler only sent his machine into the future, never into the past. I don't know if people remember that, and it's kind of a lot of people don't remember it, because I've seen him misquoted.
I didn't remember it until your book.
And there's no real logical reason he shouldn't have explored the past. He was certainly interested in history, but he never did. It never occurred to him to do that. And then when people did start doing that, they immediately discovered the terrible thing that happens. And the first terrible thing that happens is you might meet yourself. And then what? Mm. You know, and then if you're meeting yourself, what's going on? Who's meeting whom?
Mm-hmm.
One of my favorite stories investigating this is Robert Heinlein's By Your Bootstraps story. You've already used the word bootstraps, mm-hmm. right? Where, I mean, one of the things that's charming about it is that our hero, Bob, is working on his dissertation about something philosophical to do with time. We don't know exactly what. Mm-hmm. And a hole appears in the air next to him, and a man steps out of it who looks suspiciously like Bob, but he's got a 3-day growth of beard. And so, well, we already know what's going on, but Bob doesn't. Because, you know, even though Bob presumably looks in the mirror every day, he doesn't recognize himself. Mm-hmm. He just thinks this guy has showed up. So that's how early we were in the process of developing time travel literature, that it was still plausible that poor Bob would be so slow to catch on.
Right.
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 But then Heinlein, to his credit, and I mean, this is what I love about the story, is that he really starts to think about what's going on, mm-hmm. and he's got a storytelling problem. It's a fun storytelling problem, and in my book, I reproduce a piece of paper where he has like a diagram of, because his character keeps meeting itself in different places, in different times. I mean, at one point, there are 5 versions of the character all bumping into one another. But then you have to ask, and here's where we come back to consciousness, shouldn't he remember, or does he remember, the Bob who has come back through the hole certainly remembers what happened the first time, but now they're having a conversation. And they're having a conversation that, for one of them, should be scripted, because mm-hmm. he already had it. But he's acting as though he's inventing these words as he goes along.
Mm-hmm.
So what are we supposed to make of that?
Yes. Something that has been pondered in many dorm rooms since
in many dorm rooms.
The beginning of
college. Sure your kids could discuss it intelligently.
Yeah. There's a really, you know, beautiful and haunting passage in the book in which you talk about the idea that somewhere in the universe, or at lots of points in the universe, you could have a powerful telescope and look at Earth And from wherever you are, you're going to be seeing some past version of Earth. You'll Rome burning, for instance, or the very first cave people making cave drawings. I don't know, you know, that I really have a question about this. I thought it was a beautiful idea, and that is actually physical reality. That
right.
That our past is what pretty much any point in the universe would see.
Yes. No, I love that idea. And part of it is, strangely enough, that's one of the older ideas, right from the beginning of, the beginning being the 1890s at least, mm-hmm. of all this time travelish stuff. People knew that. One of the reviewers of The Time Machine made that point in his review, that when we see stars, we are seeing light from another time, not just from a distant place. People knew it because the fact that light has a finite speed had been discovered well before Einstein. It was discovered, I guess, by Maxwell, or it was certainly measured, the speed of light was determined very precisely by Maxwell. If there are any physicists in the audience who want to correct me. Yeah, and yes, that's part of it. Anyway, this is it's a beautiful idea. It's an idea that John Banville explores in his book, his novel, which is called Ancient. Okay, here's time travel. You know, this is like the end of the time travel story. Is that, you know, I'm in the middle of a sentence and somebody's Googling a correction to it. I mean, I did ask. What you said. As I'm speaking to you, you're not hearing it simultaneously. Einstein has taught us that too. It's milliseconds instead of thousands of years, but your past is my present and vice versa. And that's why time travel is with us. But even if I don't believe, as you said, in the literal machine version of time travel, there are kinds of time travel that we're learning to live with.
Yeah. I think we live in a bit of a soup, I guess, right? And Faulkner, the past is never dead, it's not even past. Yeah. And William Gibson, the future is already here, it's just unevenly distributed, which is my favorite quote of all time.
Yeah.
The kind of illusion of a universal present was destroyed, I guess, with Einstein, the idea that there is an absolute now that you could point to.
Right. And so we're all a little more alone.
That's a very depressing way of thinking about it. But yes.
Yeah. Yeah. Not to hit you with your own book again, but isn't that partly what you're exploring with your technician who, for various reasons, sometimes wants to be alone, out of time? I mean, if we all have our own clocks, which Einstein has told us, we are a little bit alone. Our sense of time is never the same as anybody else's exactly. We already sort of know that. Psychological time varies from person to person, from time to time in your own life. That's not necessarily a depressing thought. Mm-mm. We manage to communicate anyway.
Mm. Well, that's beautiful. So now I'm not depressed anymore.
Oh, good.
You really took me on a roller coaster there. No, that is quite lovely. Another thing that I found interesting in your account of the publication of Wells's novel and what followed from it was that critics and reviewers and, you know, scientists went at it pretty hard. I mean, people seem to have a kind of vehement reaction to it that it's sort of hard to imagine happening now. And I think, for me, it's tied to kind of the reality that this was a big idea that Wells had dropped into people's minds. It wasn't going to go away. And I wondered if you could talk about that, too. And I thought if we had any kind of rough analog to an idea like that now, it might be the multiverse, which you have some opinions on, the idea of multiple universes and how that seems to be sort of circulating now as something that people talk about with some kind of you know, you see it actually in the, you know, sometimes you'll see it in the New York Times, for instance, an article about are there multiple universes? And I wondered if there was anything to that parallel. And but going back to the time travel part of it, you know, sort of how important was that idea, I guess?
And right. We should do both. But yes, I mean, that's the fun of the story, is mm-hmm. that he drops this idea, and it's like a bombshell, and it is taken very seriously. And Wells himself was utterly surprised by that. He wasn't planning anything like that. He didn't think he had a great new idea. He thought he had a trick for telling a story. The purpose of his story wasn't the trick; it was the rest of the story. And there's all this, you know, the Eloi and the Morlocks, and he has visions of the future that are close to his heart. Mm-hmm. I mean, he is interested in the future and in the direction of humanity, and that stuff mattered to him, I think, you know, more than the time machine trick itself. But the time machine trick was, as you say, it was taken very seriously by people, and there were people who criticized the book by really analyzing his ideas of time travel seriously, and some of them just said it's ridiculous, but here's why it's ridiculous. That's not how time works. And then 10 or 15 years later, there's an article in the Philosophical Journal by somebody who wants to make a philosophical point about time, and the way he does it is by analyzing this fun little book by H.G. Wells. And he's also very critical of the book, but in the course of being critical of it, he takes it very seriously. Mm. And he thinks about things that Wells didn't bother thinking about. You know, he says, if the time traveler suddenly reappears, why does he necessarily have to reappear in empty space? What if he appears where there's something already there? Then maybe there'll be a big explosion. Not a ridiculous idea, and it's certainly an idea that lots of science fiction writers since then explored and played with. It's what we started by talking about. It's my view that there was this period of real turmoil, real change about how time was thought about, and it was an enriching of our notion of time. It wasn't that we thought one thing and learned anew and then thought something different. It was that we began to see a lot more possibilities. We, the entire universe of readers and writers and scientists and philosophers and psychologists and religious people, engaged in an argument that is going on to this day. I mean, it never dies out. Hmm. And should we talk about the multiverse too?
Yes.
Okay. I mean,
we already are in a different version, all right. So we might as well do it.
That's way. Right. Okay. So it makes an appearance in the book, and again, it's another one of these things that I love, where art is intersecting with science, and here the art is Jorge Luis Borges, yeah. Who was an unknown in the West Argentinian librarian / writer, and the very first of his pieces of short fiction ever to be published in the U.S., in English, mm-hmm. anywhere, was published in Ellery Queen's Mystery Magazine. And it's his story called The Garden of Forking mm-hmm. Paths. And The Garden of Forking Paths is a metaphor. It's actually, in the story, it's the name of a book. So it's a metaphor inside of a metaphor. I mean, this is the way Borges works. Mm-hmm. He's just so impossible to follow down all of his twists and turns. But in this story, I won't even attempt to say what the plot is. I'm not sure I could if I tried. But he expresses the idea of multiple universes in which everything that might happen does happen. In one universe, now to switch to the Schrödinger's cat metaphor, in one universe the cat's dead, and in another universe the cat is alive. And we happen to be in one of them, but our doppelganger is in the other one. And, you know, that's a nice idea. It's obviously absurd. until about, I don't know, 10 or 15 years later, a pretty wild thinking young physics student, graduate student named Hugh Everett, who may or may not have actually read the Borges story. I tried to find that out too. He could have. Creates a version of an interpretation of quantum mechanics that works exactly that way. He says, instead of, this is a solution to this problem of Schrödinger's cat, where in the equations, you don't really know. You have this fuzzy ball of probabilities, but at a certain point, the wave function collapses and the cat is either alive or dead, and that's a problem for the quantum theorists. And Everett says the only real way out of the problem is to take seriously the idea that what's happening is there, the universe is splitting in two. It's forking down two paths. So Borges was there first. And then, because it's so obviously ridiculous, it disappeared. Everett himself was a failure as a physicist, never published anything in physics again, until sometime, I don't know, 20 years later, 30 years later, it suddenly popped back into the mainstream of physics, and now people talk about it very seriously and would be annoyed at me for my slightly mocking tone. I still think it's just, to me, it's a symptom of physicists maybe, this isn't being televised, is it?
I don't think so.
Taking their stuff a little too seriously. The fact that the equations can lead you a certain direction, I think, doesn't entitle you to get too far away from what's supposed to be the grounding of science, after all, which is what we experience. Anyway, so I'm anti-multiverse.
In this universe, you are. But the facility with which you explain that is, I was trying to, I didn't introduce you, but if I had gotten, you know, if Louise had said, go ahead and try to introduce Jim, my stab at it would have been that if aliens came down to Earth and said, choose one representative from your species to try to summarize where you guys are at right now with science, I think you would be my nominee. it's pretty hard to do what you do.
Thank you.
So I think that alone is very impressive. And so I'm always curious to hear your opinion on a multiverse or any other opinions or any other matters. Do you have any fear of going deeper down the rabbit hole now, or should we?
Go ahead.
Okay. Because this is the question that I really want to ask. But you talk a little bit about these conversations between Einstein and Kurt Gödel at the Institute for Advanced Study in Princeton. You write, you know, beautifully about it in the book. It's a fascinating idea that two of the most important thinkers of the 20th century, probably, maybe if not the two most important, would take strolls around Princeton and just talk about the universe. I mean, what do you think those talks were like?
Have you seen those photos? Have you seen, there are a couple of photos of Einstein and Gödel walking, you know, side by side, alone. Einstein, the one I'm thinking of, Einstein's wearing a woolen hat over his otherwise recognizable fuzzy white hair. And I know, if I had a time machine,
right,
wouldn't it be nice to eavesdrop on those conversations? But we do know some of what they talked about. And the thing you're trying to draw me into talking about, see, there they go, is Gödel, as I don't need to explain who Gödel is. I mean, he was the greatest logician of the 20th century, and he engaged in paradox. He loved paradox. He used paradox to create his greatest and most troubling still, mathematical discovery. Do you want to express what it is? You've really set me up as being able to explain this kind of thing. Let's leave that and talk about his slightly wacky time travel thing, the notorious closed time-like curves. Gödel, and he gave this to Einstein as a present for Einstein's 70th birthday, discovered, worked out the equations in such a way that he could say there is a solution or a set of solutions to Einstein's equations of relativity. Mm-hmm. I don't know whether it's special or general, in which time travel to the past is possible. It's consistent with your equations, Al. And he said there is such a thing as closed time-like curves, I'm using body language now, in which you can loop back into the past, and that's consistent with the equations. Fine. It's a very specific and well-worked-out idea. It's mathematically correct. It's kind of another example of what I'm talking about, where you can't argue with the math, but you're still, I think, entitled to wonder about the reality of it. And Einstein wasn't persuaded. I mean, Einstein never really thought that Gödel had proved that time travel is possible, therefore. He merely was proving that a kind of thing is consistent with the equations. And by the way, the particular universe in which this is possible is rotating, which our universe apparently is not. I mean, there are other specific things about it that lead us to think that our universe isn't that particular universe. But even if it was, it's just a possibility. And it leaves open the question, as I said before, of whether the thing that's going back in the curve is a particle, which you could imagine, and which the equations would apply to, or a human consciousness, which is a very complicated thing. And when it goes back through time, what is supposed to happen to those memories or the experience that has accumulated? Are we supposed to think that they go back in time with it? I mean, this is where all the paradoxes come back in. And nowadays, there are plenty of physicists who still like that idea. And we'll talk about it as a real possibility. And, you know, who am I to argue except that I don't choose to believe in it, even though I've just written a whole book about it. You'd think I'd be in favor.
Well,
was that an answer?
Yeah, it was absolutely an answer. Dennett has a quote, Daniel Dennett, that, let's see if I can get it right. Sometimes an impossibility in fact is more interesting than a possibility in principle. I think that goes to what you're talking about, which is we seem to constantly run into the same roadblock when you start to try to grapple with some of these paradoxes. And instead of looking strictly to a kind of technical mathematical solution, for instance, or to something that seems possible on paper, it still counts. Our intuition about our common sense, our most kind of basic understanding of what makes any kind of sense to us still can't be completely just thrown out just because the physics says something is possible. Is that a fair kind of
summation? Yes, exactly. Yes, that's really beautifully put. And that's the other side of the coin of why I care about this stuff. I mean, it's true. The impossibility of it is, now that we've established it, it doesn't matter, because these stories are expressing something very true and very real, and each variation on the theme is expressing something different. And that's the real reason that we love them. It's not just a game. If the Back to the Future movies have Michael J. Fox get in a DeLorean and zoom back to the past, there's something very emotional that's being captured there. There's a very real experience that every teenager has, or at least many teenagers have. When you get to a certain age, you look at your parents and you go, aha, they were teenagers too. And what was that like? And did they have the same feelings that I'm having now? And did they, were they like kids falling in love? And do I, can I have any access to that? That's what, that's what's happening. I mean, one of the things that's, not to oversimplify that story. Mm-hmm. And in each of the time travel fictions that I explore at varying lengths and at different points in my book, there's always something like that. There's some reality of human experience that not only is being captured by the story, but if it's really successful, you end up feeling couldn't have been captured any other way. Thank you for that question, for bringing me back to what mattered.
Okay, now I'm going to make you angry. I promised I would make you angry. Why do you hate time capsules so much? They have a special...
Oh, yeah, time capsules.
You say they represent a special kind of foolishness.
I don't hate them. I mean, you got me you got me into this nice emotional mood, and there's something there's something lovely about time capsules. So I'll work back around to that. Okay. I have a chapter all about time capsules. I don't know when I got the idea that that would belong in my time travel book, but it's another variation on the theme. You know, time capsules. This is a thing that we do. We're not talking about things that you get into to travel through time. We're talking about the kind of time capsules where people bury stuff and say, do not open until the year 2100, right? And so one interesting fact about that is that just like time travel, time capsules are pretty new, older than time travel, but not that much older. I think they started around the centennial of the U.S., so that would be 1876. That's approximate. People started celebrating centennials generally, which humans had not always done through all history. The 100-year, the round number anniversaries started to become important. And by the way, we're just now completely obsessed with these round number anniversaries, right? I mean, what is this year the centennial of? Google it, not you. you'll discover 100 things. People started burying things, and Charlie's right. I do kind of make fun of the idea. I do think it was a little bit silly. In particular, there was a really very elaborate and complicated and much publicized time capsule that was buried. When was it? Around the time of the first New York World's Fair, or the second New York World's Fair? One of the New York World's Fairs. 1939, let's say. And they filled it with stuff. And they took it very seriously. There were messages. They tape recorded? No. They wrote down, sorry, anachronism. They wrote down messages from famous people such as Einstein. What is your message to the people of the future? Thomas Mann, they asked. And they put stuff like women's stockings in the capsule, or women's hats, and they put Tinker Toys, Lincoln Logs. Mm. They didn't have Tinker Toys yet, probably another anachronism. Lincoln Logs, though, for sure. And then they very grandly announced, we are burying the 20th century. This is in 1950 or something. It was too soon to think you're burying the 20th century.
Hubris.
And another thing about time capsules is a lot more of them get buried than ever get dug up. they get lost, and silly stuff gets buried. And really, do we really think that people in the year 6000 are going to be waiting with bated breath to see what's in our particular time capsule? No, that's not how we are transmitting our culture to the future. We have many other living means of transmitting culture. We have museums, we have schools, we have life.
Books.
We have culture. But I don't hate time capsules. And again, there is something sweet about them. I mean, they do capture a moment. Mm. You can look at what's buried in a time capsule, you don't have to dig up the time capsule to find out, because they wrote it all down and they did newspaper stories about it. But you look at what they buried in a particular year, and you're getting a kind of snapshot of what seemed important to some people in a particular place on this planet at a particular time.
Well, I think that's as good a place as any to end and take questions.
We are going to, if we have a little bit of time for questions, if I see some hands up.
Given your idea that time travel started with Wells, how does Connecticut Yankee fit into that theory? Is it the intentionality?
Okay, this is good, because this is a good question for several reasons. One reason is it's natural for people to immediately start proving me wrong and thinking of the exceptions. And there are exceptions. I mean, you could ask about Rip Van Winkle. You could ask about Charles Dickens and A Christmas Carol. You could ask about ancient legends where people fall asleep and wake up many years later. And yes, so if you know, you want to sort of pin me down to what I'm saying, it is partly the intentionality. It is partly the idea of a machine, although a lot of time travel dispenses with the machine and you just pop through a portal or something. But it's kind of the thought that you can, what if you could go to a particular place in the past or the future? That's kind of the new idea. But also, Connecticut Yankee is a great, I love that example, and it's only 5 years before Wells. And if for those of you who have forgotten how the Connecticut Yankee gets back to King Arthur's court, he gets bonked on the head, knocked unconscious, and he wakes up. So it's partly a dream, but it's also very much a part of what I've been talking about, this new attitudes about time, because really what Mark Twain is exploring is the difference between the technology that is arriving around Mark Twain at high speed in 19th century America. Mark Twain had his typewriter and he was one of the first people on his block to get a new telephone. Mm. He was very interested in technology, and his guy goes back to King Arthur's court and becomes king of the world, or at least a wizard, by showing them technologies from 19th century America.
And Jim does talk about some of the antecedents and possible precursors to the idea in the book in some detail.
Next question.
Was there a time or a period when humanity stopped seeing time just as passing or happening to a time when it was being spent?
That's an interesting question, and I think the answer is, I don't think so. I think that, first of all, I don't think we've stopped. I don't think we've actually made a transition, have we? I think that right now, we are capable of talking about time as a thing that passes. We're capable of talking about time as a thing that you spend. We talk about wasting time. We talk about saving time. We sometimes think of time as a river that's carrying us along. We sometimes think about moving through time, or, you know, are we moving or is time moving? Who knows? I don't know. I think that the interesting thing, the thing that matters, is that we're capable of having these contradictory ideas in our head at the same time. And the fact that they are contradictory doesn't mean we're idiots. It means we are capable of thinking about time in a pretty complicated way.
Thank you. I hope I can recall the time traveler well enough. As I remember, just before he departs for the last time, he's with his circle of friends, he disappears, and they notice that one book has been taken from his bookshelf. So the question would be, any thought on what one book he took with him into the future?
No, I don't know. I mean, honestly, I didn't remember that detail. It's another thing that you can Google. And no, I don't mean to repeat that joke. There's actually something serious to say about all the Googling, but no, I don't know. Can't answer that.
Next question over on this side here.
Hi. Back in the 70s, I taught a class in New York called Ancient Astronauts and UFOs. And I'm a pretty rational person. And I don't know, in the second class, somebody raised their hand and said they were from Pluto. And in the next class, somebody raised their hand and they had either they had had sex on a UFO or something like that. The whole class, we had 150 people. The whole class was filled with that. I ended up being kind of where you are today. But my question is, are you ready for somebody to stand up in front of you and convincingly tell you, I come from 2019? Or the image I like is you're playing a game on a computer, Sims City, and you say to somebody, you grab the little guy and you say, go to work. And he turns to you and he says, I don't feel like working today. Are you personally ready for that moment when everything just unhinges and everything you've written about, which you don't think is going to happen, does? Mm. And then nobody's going to believe you, of course.
Personally, I don't know. What a great, you know, it's a great possibility. It sounds like, I want to say, it would be really fun. I would take some convincing. And in all of the time travel stories, or in a lot of them, that's how it starts. There's somebody with a pretty plausible story and somebody else who needs some convincing. And you know, wouldn't that be fun? I hope not. I mean, I've been wrong about so many things in my life that I'd be happy to be wrong about this. I mean, you know, people, while I was working on this book from time to time, people would say, what are you working on? And I would say, I'm working on a book about time travel, and they would react in different ways. But the best reaction I got was somebody who said, oh, cool, have you done it?
Hi. I just read The Forever War, and I loved its use of relatively realistic physics, like relativistic travel, as a plot device. I was just wondering what your favorite uses of time travel as plot devices are.
What? I didn't hear the thing you just read.
The Forever War.
The Forever War.
Joe Haldeman?
I don't know. The plot devices get so interesting and so much more complicated and mind-stretching. I actually do sort of have a favorite. I don't have one favorite. I mean, there are so many things that fall in the category of time travel. I mean, Groundhog Day is a kind of time travel movie, right?
It is.
He's living the same thing over and over again. A movie that I spend a certain amount of time talking about is the fairly obscure cult film by Chris Marker, La Jetée. I know some of you will know it. I see some heads nodding, and others of you will be completely mystified. And it's a short, less than a half hour, I think, black and white film composed almost entirely of still images. And it has a very interesting time travel twist. And it's essentially, fundamentally, the same time travel twist that's used in the movie 12 Monkeys with Bruce Willis. And I'm not going to ruin it. If you know the twist, even if you know the twist, it's going to take you a few minutes to refresh your memory about what actually happens. There are really weird things that happen when you're plotting a time travel story, right? I mean, we have an expert on the stage with us. I'll say this one last thing, which is almost embarrassing. There was a point early on in the process of writing this book when I kind of thought, okay, there's all this great time travel stuff, but really it's coming to an end. The possibilities have been exhausted. It's not, everything's been done now. We're going to get to a point, and partly because of this is where Google seriously comes into the picture, partly because of the way the world is our world is changing and our relationship with time is being sped up and our sense of the now is being expanded by being online all the time. I thought, really, time travel might be over. And that is turned out to be so wrong. It's so embarrassing. I mean, so many wonderful new books are being written. I mean, besides Charlie's, another of my favorite of the really recent time travel books is The Peripheral by William Gibson, which has, in a way, a very stripped down kind of time travel plot, because the only thing that can travel through time is information, not physical beings. What can you do with that? He works it out. One more question.
Right over here.
Thank you so much for a really interesting evening. I'm wondering if you can boil down the essence, the poetic essence, if you will, of information theory and entropy. I mean, the words imply something obvious to me, but I'm so moved by the ever-present now of being online and the plot twists of time travel and the creativity that will never be exhausted by writers to invent and devise and go through that warp, that hole, and find it beyond facts. I mean, fiction is unbelievable. And I like so much the notions that you're throwing around. And can you, for a layperson, boil down information theory and entropy? I know you didn't want to have the people walk out, but there must be a poetic essence, a kernel that you can convey.
This is a challenge, and I know I'm guessing that a lot of people in the audience are thinking that it's unfair to ask me to do that, and I can't really do it. But I'll say this about the reason there's a connection between information and entropy. I think I can express in a simple way, and the connection has to do with uncertainty. It has to do with what isn't known. Information, I'm talking about the other book now, as a scientific thing, is about measuring uncertainty, reducing uncertainty. When you measure information, what you're really measuring is uncertainty, and so is entropy. You flip a coin, that's one bit of information. You're actually generating a bit of information in a way, because until it comes down, it can be heads or tails, but when it comes down, it's settled. And yes, even though it was unfair for you to ask me about the previous book, I appreciate the question, and it is connected to what we've been talking about, I think. I mean, this is what time travel is about also. It's about not knowing. If you want to travel into the future, it's because we don't know what's still to come. And if you want to travel back into the past, it's to make connections between things that have been lost to us.
You are proving my point about the aliens. As human representative, I expected a good answer. That was an excellent answer. So
thank you.
Thank you all.
And for the very good question.
Aloud is made possible through support provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the National Endowment for the Arts, and Errant Fox. Additional support provided by the Los Angeles Public Library, the Stay Home and Read a Book Ball, Sharon Oxborough, the estate of Suzanne Aaron, Donna and Martin J. Wolfe, Julia Meltzer, and individual Library Foundation members. Media support is provided by LA Weekly, KCRW 89.9 FM, and KUSC 91.5 FM. Music by Boya Pongo. Support these free programs by becoming a member of the Library Foundation of Los Angeles. Visit lfla.org for more information.